I've always been intrigued by these 19th century Unitarian efforts at utopian community. And as much as I admire the idealism inherent in these communities, I really wish I could ask the folks at Fruitland, what were you thinking? I mean, maybe that would work in Hawaii, but in New England? Like, come on! Like, now, many of these utopian thinkers, as you've heard, had their roots in the Transcendentalist movement. And Transcendentalism really was a crisis of faith that murmured throughout that generation. Transcendentalists rejected the rationalistic material enlightenment thinking. They believed in the divine authority of Christianity that didn't require literal acceptance of the miracles of the Bible. And they felt that the truth of religion does not depend upon tradition nor historical facts, but on the unerring witness of the soul. So this was pretty radical stuff in the 1840s. These were maybe the original spiritual but not religious people, right? Brook Farm resident Elizabeth Peabody, Palmer Peabody wrote, "Transcendentalism belongs to no sect of religion and no social party. It is the common good to which all sects may rise and be purified of their narrowness, for it consists in seeking the spiritual ground of all manifestations. There is a light that enlightened every person that cometh into the world. There is a faculty in all, the most degraded, the most ignorant, the most obscure, this faculty to perceive spiritual truth when distinctly presented. And the ultimate appeal of all moral questions is not a jury of scholars, a hierarchy of divines, or the prescriptions of creed. But the ultimate appeal is to the common sense of the human race." That's pretty cool stuff for the 1840s, isn't it? And can you hear the roots of our own respect for religious pluralism in there? Can you hear the early articulation of our UU principles in there? The inherent worth and dignity of all people? A free and responsible search for truth and meaning that is not tied down to dogma? But for all its notoriety, the Transcendental Movement lasted only a few years and was really a very loose connection of Boston elite religious outcasts. The official Transcendental Club, a gathering of those thought leaders at the time, lasted only from 1836 to 1840. They contributed to a journal called The Dial, which I might add was edited by a woman, Margaret Fuller, for much of its tenure. And this group came together 30 times over the course of these 4 years to discuss what were then uncommon matters of their times. Things like mysticism and Christianity, pantheism, or the nature of poetry. And for much of their time, they could agree to disagree. But ironically, it was precisely the desire to create utopian communities that did more to highlight the differences of this group than to bind them together. In fact, although no one knew it at the time, on September 1840, that meeting of the club, of the Transcendental Club, when George Ripley personally invited Ralph Waldo Emerson to join Brook Farm, proved to be the last meeting of that group. After leaving his Unitarian pulpit, Ripley was convinced that the church failed to bring the religion of society into accordance with the religion of Christ. Brook Farm was his attempt to do that, to bring those things together. And in a letter to Emerson about joining the group, Ripley wrote, "Our objects are to ensure a more natural union between intellectual and manual labor than now exists, to guarantee the highest mental freedom by providing all with labor adapted to their tastes and talents, and whose relations with one another would permit a more simple and wholesome life." That's a beautiful objective to have, to bring all those things together. And it took Emerson a full 5 weeks to reply to Ripley's proposal to join his community. It really required Emerson to confront his own inner struggles between the polarities of solitude and society. And in the end, Emerson chose solitude as his understanding of what best serves humanity. So buried in his long response to George Ripley was this: "I think that all I shall solidly do, I must do alone." And throughout his writings, we can see the same thing repeated in lines like, "Isn't a man better than a town?" Emerson went on to pursue secular individualism. Ripley and others might be loosely gathered as religious egalitarianism through the building of their communities. Others moved on to a more traditional Unitarianism of the time. And still others, folks like abolitionist Theodore Parker, moved more to a progressive Unitarian Christianity. So they all split up in their differences. What we see here is the fundamental disagreements along a continuum of individual and community, I versus we. And it's one of the profound human questions that each of us really have. Each of us in our own lives is always making that discernment along that continuum of how much togetherness will bring me to personal wholeness. What's best, not only for me, but for the future of all of us? Is it better to separate out? Or is it better to be a part of something larger and deal with the messiness and imperfection of whatever community we're a part of? And although these three Unitarian communities were valiant efforts at creating something new and pretty cool in their own right, we see that the legacy of transcendentalism lies with the likes of Emerson and his other famous colleagues like Henry David Thoreau. It reminds me of the building of the Christian canon, where there was these kind of years of swirling around and of ideas, and then a few ideas kind of stuck, and the rest of them kind of got forgotten. Now, I'm not a transcendentalist scholar, so I'm treading on dicey ground here this morning, critiquing such great men of history. But I can see that this ideology that moved more towards solitude and the individual has some challenges that continue to haunt us to this day. Because for all the good that Emerson and others in the movement helped us with our own sense of self-reliance, they brought into the world, they also tipped it heavily toward individualism over and above individuality. So let me describe that for you. Individuality is about the development of one's own unique being in the world that is capable of then connecting to others. And individualism is making oneself the center of one's preoccupations and self-interest. So it's a smaller pond. It's that narrowness that Elizabeth Peabody was trying to avoid. Do you see that difference, individuality and individualism? So in an honorary speech known as the Berry Street Lecture, my colleague, the Reverend Fred Muir, writes, "As a patriarch of American transcendentalism, Emerson contributed to shaping 20th century ideology and the story that Americans tell about ourselves. That story is about American uniqueness and individualism. Clearly, our American culture has largely succumbed to individualism, to a narrowing of self-interest designed to protect those in power who make the decisions." Can you see that in how we're governed? But we know that these Boston elite, even those who preach self-sufficiency most loudly, remained connected and dependent on others. Henry David Thoreau, famed for going to live simply in the woods by himself at Walden Pond, took his laundry to his mother to do every week. I'm totally serious, right? And in exchange, he did handiwork for her. So there was an interdependence there, although his writing, which we have glommed onto, is about a profound individuality, individual self-reliance. I know, right? God. So, and ironically, even whole communities of people need to decide how their community will relate to others further outside of them. And looking back, we can see how these utopian communities fell prey to that reductionist theology of creating self-contained communities. Brook Farm, for example, created its own education system, which was highly regarded, but it was something that even Emerson questioned, acknowledging the other fine opportunities for education that existed in the area. And Fruitlands, well, as I said, they're a bit short-sighted in their plans, and really, it was to their own detriment. Unitarian historian Conrad Wright wrote, "For both Emerson and Theodore Parker, a true community is not painfully constructed by people who have struggled to learn how to live together, but is made up of atomic and unrelated individuals." That was what they were hoping for. "And this ideology," he continues, this is Conrad Wright, the historian, "is a part of the disintegration of institutional religion. Because one cannot build a church on Emerson's words, such as, 'Men are less together than they are alone, and men descend to meet.'" Now, looking back, Emerson, as brilliant as he was, also looks like a real curmudgeon, doesn't he? But to this day, our Unitarian Universalist congregations have fallen prey to this reductionist nature of the more isolationist side of Emerson's ideology. For years, congregations have misinterpreted our rejection of the hierarchy of church structure as a need for independence. We've created autonomous and even competitive, individualistic religious institutions rather than interdependent ones, which really are a part of the covenantal founding of the American religious tradition. We fled from England because the hierarchy did not let churches relate to one another this way, not only this way. And even within congregations, and even here, we create silos within our ministries, succumbing to a very narrow understanding of what our true work is together. Again, my colleague Fred Muir writes, "We Unitarian Universalist congregations are being held captive by a persistent, pervasive, disturbing, and disruptive commitment to individualism that misguides our ability to engage the changing times." So now, 175 years after the powerful historical moment that was transcendentalism, we're still living largely in this paradigm as an American culture, and also, I believe, as congregations. But new ways are emerging, ways that bring us out of the reductionist understanding of ourselves in relationship to others, and really acknowledge our profound interdependence. My friends, beloved community is not found in here. Instead, we are a community of disparate beliefs joined together in a vision to bring love and reason and justice and compassion out into the world. We are the lab for doing that. But the more we gather thinking that what we cherish most is our like-mindedness, the less we are able to reach, even within ourselves, reach out in our differences and learn to be together that way. To seek beloved community only here, to stay cozy in our comfortable congregational way of being, is to fall prey to that individualism. It's what Fred Muir calls the I church. Seeking a smaller self-interest, plugging ourselves into that, just that which works for us. It keeps us safe, but closed to our profound interdependence, and really limits our ability to serve the world and heal our own selves of the fracturedness that is in our own lives. The roots of transcendentalism point the way to an expansive concept of beloved community. Let me return to Elizabeth Peabody again that I said in the beginning. Transcendentalism belongs to no sect of religion and no social party. It is the common good to which all sects may arise, for it consists in seeking the spiritual ground of all manifestations. It's a pretty grand vision, isn't it? And it's a vision we have held on to in ideal, if not in practice. But I wonder what would have happened if the Transcendentalist Club had been able to continue meeting, building bridges across their differences, rather than avoiding the tension that arose when differences presented as polarities. I wonder how it might have even changed the course of our nation. If instead of a 4-year experiment that then got broken, if they figured it out then. In our pluralistic religious communities, we can redeem their work and return back to that grand vision, steadfastly practicing living covenantally differently and linking ourselves to others to build the beloved community that is much wider and broader than we can even imagine right now. A few weeks ago, I went to a conference in Baltimore that was hosted by PICO, which is the national network of which Together Colorado is a part. You'll be hearing more about that, my experience there last week, but it was, I would say, beautifully troubling. Beautifully troubling. I was there amongst faith leaders from all traditions, lay leaders and organizers, joined together across our differences. There were Muslims and Jews and Christians of all, you know, liberal Christians and conservative Christians, African-American Baptist ministers and women Muslim clerics who were trying to have more power in their own denomination. But we were all pointed in the same direction, towards the creation of a new narrative for this country, a narrative that puts human dignity at the center, rather than the consolidation of power of the few on the backs of the many. A narrative that seeks to honor all of creation rather than raping the earth of her limited resources. And on the last day of this conference, I sat in the auditorium and I was looking around me at the faces of the people that I had met that week. People like the man who lived in Richmond, California, and in conversation with me, he was telling me about Richmond, a very poor community in California, he said, "Where are all the men in this community?" And someone told him they're in San Quentin prison up the road. And I felt the link and the bond to him. And in that space, I looked around at all the many conversations and people that I had met, and I had this profound experience of this is the beloved community. Difference brought together towards a common purpose that helps all of us live into wholeness. This is also, I think, the sparks of that we can see in the Transcendentalist movement. Sparks that got covered over and shifted towards a false sense of individualism. We, my friends, can go back to that and do that work, repairing both the fracturedness of our own lives and the fracturedness of this nation and indeed the world by taking seriously our own covenantal relationships, not only to one another, but to the larger world that we are a part. May it be so.